The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
You're listening to Radical Grassroots Media, the most popular and reviled socialist radio broadcast in the iTunes universe. Radio, like change that can only come from below. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. Radio with a revolutionary socialist perspective. Here's your host, Anthony Udell.
And welcome, welcome, welcome to this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. I am your host, Anthony Udell. This is radio, as the man said, with a revolutionary socialist perspective. Seeing Red Radio comes to you every Thursday from 8 until 9. If you are terrestrially within Western Massachusetts at Valley Free Radio 103.3 FM, you can also, if you are elsewhere, check out the web stream at valleyfreeradio.org, where we are continually streaming. Of course, if you miss Seeing Red Radio and you need your weekly dose of class war fighting socialism, well, by all means, check out seeingredradio.org. Tune in to the podcast. On this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio, we're going to start on the international front line of the international class war. We're going to start in the junkyards of Kabul, Afghanistan, with little boys who have to pick through garbage just to stay alive. Thank you, capitalist imperialism. We'll also look at the maze that aid must travel through aid agencies in order to get to its rightful place in Afghani reconstruction. Thank you, United Nations. We'll also include a story about Israeli divestment and boycott, the movement that is spreading across the United States. We'll feature an Al Jazeera report on that. We'll also have Noam Chomsky speaking about Obama's foreign policy appointments and their pro-Israeli hawkish stances. And we'll pepper the whole evening with a little Sherry Wolf, frequent contributor to the Socialist Worker and to the International Socialist Review. She gave a talk that we'll feature excerpts from at Marxism Forum 2007 in Melbourne, Australia, an event sponsored by Socialist Alternative. We'll also feature music by David Rovics, Asian Dub Foundation, Michael Franti, Linton Kwesi Johnson, and even the Godfather of Soul. That's all on this week's edition of Seeing Red. Stay tuned.
From early morning until night falls, these children work every day without a break. Child labour has many forms. This must be one of the most unbearable. Aid agencies call it rag picking. It's a polite description for scavenging. Nadim says he's 8 years old, but he's not much bigger than the bag on his back. I collect batteries, he says, rubber, plastic, and bottles of glass. The sacks Nadim fills are purchased for a tiny sum and shipped off to Pakistan for recycling. I ask him what he enjoys doing when he's not working. I don't do anything else, he says. I just go and collect water for my mother.
Obama may have the energy and the anger and the networks of the anti-war vote, but he does not have a plan to get us out of Iraq. What he has is a plan to downsize the occupation of Iraq, not to end it. He talks about keeping the green zone intact and calls that ending the war. Let me tell you, you cannot keep the green zone, which is the symbol of the foreign occupation of Iraq, without a massive troop presence that includes the military contractors like Blackwater as well.
Work that will bring real and lasting change for generations to come.
But will it really work?
Are you kidding me? Give me the $14,000. I'll do more than those bureaucrats will do with it.
It's revolution insurance. That's what it is, because this thing continues to grow And, you know, the people take to the streets with the pitchforks and the torches, and the whole thing goes up and smoke. You know,
the haves have just run rampant over the have-nots.
These children spend their days crawling through the mountains of rubbish. The smell here is almost indescribable. It grabs the pit of your stomach and pinches the back of your throat. But for them, it's the sad and desperate reality. Across Kabul, an estimated 37,000 children work on the streets. Those figures are said to be conservative. In a country torn apart by war, with an economy barely functioning, there are few other options for some families.
If these children do not work, you know that they will themselves cannot survive because they are earning income for their survival. And also they are feeding the family members. So this is the main problem.
Conscious of the impact on families, aid organizations and the government here are reluctant to withdraw children from employment. But with all the billions of dollars pouring into Afghanistan, why don't countless development projects do anything to help these people?
It doesn't really cater to the needs of the poorest of the poor, who doesn't have work, who never had opportunity for education, yet they're struggling, and then they have the children to support. So the coping mechanism for them is to, you know, send out the kids and then survive for the day.
Foreign politicians and military leaders talk constantly about improving the lives of ordinary Afghans. But in places like this, it's hard to believe that this messy war has achieved anything.
If you knew the earth was dying, if they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse, if you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes, if you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide, if you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts, what if you knew? The bombs are falling, if they showed them hit the ground, if you could see the bodies flying, if you could hear the sound, if you could see the rubble where the hospital once stood, if you saw the child's lifeless limbs, would you hold them if you could? If you knew that they were lying every time they spoke, for every laser-guided pinprick, there were lives lost in the smoke. If instead of just the generals, they had doctors too to describe the carnage of the cluster bombs, what if you knew? They were saying when they think you cannot hear, if you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear, if you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse, if you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew? You knew that you were living in a huge conspiracy. Would you leave your suburbs, get out of your SUV? Would you hit the streets and fight for all our lives? Would you hold your ground when the stormtroopers arrive? If you knew that the whole planet depended on what you do now, would you take a man with the speed our times allow? If the pundits told the truth for just a week or two and real life was shown on TV, what if you knew?
If you ever wondered why the people of Afghanistan have lost faith in the reconstruction process, then take a look at the Khair Khana Hospital in Kabul.
Suitable for patients.
No water.
It is quite simply a medical nightmare. One of the first major aid projects in the country, it was meant to be a showpiece example of what the West could do for Afghanistan. $2.2 million of donor cash was given to build this facility.
Come.
All from Italian taxpayers. But most of the money never reached the hospital. Instead, it filled the coffers of aid agencies along the way. The toilets don't flush, lethal wires hang from the walls, and the structure threatens to come down on the patient's head at any moment.
Everybody wants money. Everybody's at it. For each contract that comes in, a consultant and advisor comes with it. They all take their 10%.
This man knows what he's talking about. He has been handling major construction projects for foreign contractors since the US-led invasion 7 years ago. He agreed to talk to us, providing we concealed his identity.
These consultants are all young boys from America, from Germany, from abroad, but mainly from the US. They come here because they can get jobs easily as consultants, and they can make a lot of money.
A foreign contractor is paid on average between $1,000 and $2,000 a day. Everywhere you go in Kabul, there are examples of mismanagement by foreign construction firms. This half-built highway is the road to Kandahar. The road project was started 6 years ago by a Turkish construction firm, but only one side of the highway has been completed. It has become a joke amongst ordinary Afghans. This is why hearts and minds are being lost in Afghanistan. Back in the hospital, winter is coming, and it's getting cold for the patients.
Is it cold here in the winter?
Yes, yes, very much.
How cold?
Maybe 0 Celsius. The patients themselves have to bring with them stoves and something for heating.
The hospital was built without a heating system. So in the sub-zero conditions of an Afghan winter, the patients are forced to bring in their own heating.
How they could do it and why they do it? Really, it's for me it's amazing, and I cannot convince myself why did they do it with Afghans.
The Afghan government has finally had enough. They are now openly accusing the United Nations of corruption.
There are a lot of people that are involved in corruption within the UN and external aid agencies and also local Afghan countrymen also. Nobody have thought about such a conspiracy and such a corruption within organizations like UNFPA and UNPS and UN as a whole.
The Afghan government recently concluded an inquiry into the building of the hospital, and this is what they say happened. In 2003, the United Nations Office for Project Services, or UNOPS, was given $2.2 million to build the hospital. They then handed the job over to an Italian NGO, taking a $270,000 management fee in the process. That left just under $2 million for the new hospital. But then the Italian NGO, called Intersos, is alleged to have taken $1 million out of that budget in its admin fees before passing the project on to a local Afghan company. So that left just $900,000 in the kitty to build the hospital. I wrote to UNOPS twice requesting the records for the project. This was their reply.
Due to the single audit principle of the United Nations, UNOPS is not allowed to release any records of this nature, i.e. bidding documents, contracts, subcontracts, accounting records, etc.
In the winter season, the most children develop pneumonia, and it can be very dangerous in winter season.
Less than 20 minutes drive from the Khair Khana Hospital is the UNOPS Kabul headquarters. Its new director, an Australian named Bruce McCarran, was keen to show me around his offices.
This is our customs and trade facilitation project.
They were built around the same time as the hospital, but it's like another world. There is no shoddy wiring or plumbing, and nobody has to bring a heater to work here. Bruce McCarran wasn't in charge at the time of the hospital's construction, but he agreed to talk to me about what happened.
From what I can see on the files, the project went reasonably well. A 52-bed hospital was what was asked for, and that was what was delivered.
It doesn't work at all. Also, that one is also out of work.
Bruce McCarran told me he'd never visited the hospital, despite the controversy surrounding it. He says the Afghan government have failed to maintain the hospital.
We've not seen anything that substantiates any problem with the hospital. What we would question, what we'd ask is, has there any maintenance been done on the facility in the last 5 years? Everything we do is funded from the projects we deliver. And so, of course, there's an administrative fee that's taken off the top of each project, but we do not work for profit. We work for client satisfaction.
UNOPS resolutely rejects any criticism of its management and says it simply took its admin fee and handed the contract on to the Italian NGO, Intersos. I called Intersos to get their version of events.
I can tell you for sure that the contract we had with UNOPS was equal to $900,000.
So just to be clear, you're saying the contract you received from UNOPS was for $900,000?
Yes.
Not for one point nine million.
No way.
So astonishingly, that leaves more than $1 million of the hospital's budget unaccounted for.
The money was lost during all these passages, not in the building of the hospital. It's a shame of the international community that such an hospital stands there. It's really a shame. I mean, it shouldn't be there and it shouldn't be like this.
But the very next day, Monica Matarazzo got back to me. She had made a mistake. They had spent the missing million. And she had a breakdown of costs to prove it. But the Afghan Attorney General's office has seen those costs and say they don't explain the missing money. He wants the individuals involved prosecuted.
Of course, it makes us Afghans much disappointed, because the ordinary Afghans, they don't have good memories from the foreigners.
What happened to over $1 million of the hospital budget? Not to mention the $5 billion that the Afghan government says has gone missing since the West began rebuilding Afghanistan.
A big American firm was given a contract to build a school. The original budget was $260,000. They passed it on to an American NGO for I don't know how much. Then they passed it on to us for $130,000. And I think in the end, we only spent around $70,000 on the school itself.
The aid is not getting through to the people who need it most. UNOPS is currently the subject of an internal UN investigation. The Italian NGO continues to work in Afghanistan, funded by European taxpayers. Barack Obama has said he wants to make Afghanistan his foreign policy priority. He plans to send more troops, but if he wants to win Afghan hearts and minds, he will also have to restore some integrity to Afghanistan's reconstruction. After all, if you can't build a hospital, how can you ever build the peace?
Never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture. They're telling you that you will never see the horror. Spend it all today and we will bill you tomorrow. And bank accounts in Bahamas. Wall Street crime will never send you to the slammer. Tell all the children in the arms of the mamas, the F-15 is a homicide bomber. TV commercial for a popper pill culture. Drug companies circling like a vulture. Amiraki babies with the G.I. Joe father. 10 years from now, is anybody gonna bother? Yeah, fire. Never come with a warning, a revolution. Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green. From the banks of the river to the banks of the greedy. All of the riches taken back by the needy. We come from the country and we come from the city. Play us on a record, you can play us on a CD. All the giving us is fertilizer. The seeds that you planted, you can never brutalize. Down a corporation, you can never globalize it. Like Peter Tosh said, legalize it. Girls and boys hear the bass and the treble. Rumble in the speakers and it make you want a rebel. Throw your hands up, take it to another level. And you never, ever, ever make a deal with the devil. Yeah, fire. revolution never send you an omen. Revolution never come with a warning.
What we propose as socialists is workers' power. We believe that the people who produce the wealth in society ought to control that wealth and ought to democratically control how society is run. Now, obviously, the first argument that people come up with, and it's not an unreasonable question to ask, is how is it that workers could possibly ever run the society we live in? Most working people, after all, accept a number of ideas that justify the status quo. Having their heads at any given time alongside of perhaps some progressive ideas, not the crap ideas, racist ideas, homophobic ideas, sexist ideas, all that sorts of nonsense. But even more prominent, I think, even if you're somebody who's got all sorts of progressive, sort of left-wing ideas about those sorts of things, it's probably the most common idea that workers have in their minds, is that there's really not much that you can do to change the world. Things suck, but they've more or less always been like that, and the best that you can do is sort of go along to get along, meet me at the bar, that kind of thing. And Marx had a very succinct way of putting it. He said that the dominant ideas in every society are the ideas of the ruling class. And so the schools, the churches, the various institutions, and obviously the media, all of these various outlets for the top class in society to disseminate their ideas are hard at work in reinforcing these sorts of backwardness. But I think in some ways the very fact that they have to go through extraordinary lengths every single day to repeat backward crap tells you something, in my mind, about how unnatural these ideas are. Because if these were the natural ideas that we all had in our heads, then why would you have to spend billions of dollars, promoting them? People would simply have them, and you don't have to bother inculcating people every single day with, you're powerless, you're stupid, you're worthless, you're going to work, stand in size order, blah 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 blah. And I think that's an important thing for us to understand. There's nothing natural or inevitable about the mixed consciousness that most workers have in their heads at any given time.
It looks like one of the many protests against Israel's war on Gaza that have taken place across the United States since December. But when you take a closer look, these New Yorkers aren't just calling on Israel to stop the bombing or end the occupation. They're picketing Lev Leviv, Israel's top exporter of polished diamonds.
All your diamonds cannot hide!
Yes, apartheid!
And they say they're part of a growing global movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
All your diamonds cannot hide!
Rehan Barghouti is an organizer with the New York group Adalah, or Justice.
Well, boycott, divestment, sanctions was put forward by Palestinian civil society. So in 2005, in terms of a Palestinian strategy to respond to Israeli occupation and aggression, not only in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but its violations of Palestinian rights inside Israel and against the Palestinian refugees.
Boycott, divest, sanction. It's a strong slogan, but what does it mean here on the ground? These activists from Adalah, New York, are focusing their boycott efforts on the Lev Leviv Diamond Boutique here on Madison Avenue. They're targeting Leviv because they say he's using African diamonds to build Israeli settlements on Palestinian lands. In the 16 months since they started boycotting Leviv, Adalah has managed to get charities Oxfam and UNICEF to disavow their ties to Leviv's philanthropic initiatives. It's a small victory compared to the $3 billion worth of aid the U.S. sends to Israel each year.
Okay.
Lev Leviv's company refused to speak with us.
We'll have no answer from here.
But Israel's Consul General, Asaf Sharif, was quick to condemn boycott attempts.
In the history we saw, this is exactly what the Nazis tried to do. If you talk about apartheid, there was signs that you cannot buy from stores of Jews. So we saw that in the past.
That's the card that gets pulled out
when all else fails.
Bill Fletcher's a labor activist. He played a key role in the movement to get the U.S. to sanction apartheid South Africa. Now he's on the advisory board of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation.
You can talk about apartheid. You can talk about the assassinations that the Israeli Mossad carries out. You can talk about the number of truces that Israel has broken. All of these things, which in and of themselves should be enough to at least raise a question mark for people. And then, trump card, the Holocaust.
Katie Unger is a Jewish-American member of Adala.
A lot of Jewish young people are brought up with a really unquestioning attitude toward Israel, and in fact a much less questioning attitude than that goes on in Israel itself.
Boycott activists often talk about the obstacles presented by the well-organized Israel lobby within the United States. But they face another challenge, too.
Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, the community that is typically makes up the base of the pro-Palestinian community in this country, are still largely an immigrant community, and it's going to take a while before we start inserting ourselves into having a pervasive role in American society.
Divestment campaigns preceded this latest wave of boycott activity. Badi Kilblawi began organizing to get his university to divest from companies with ties to Israel almost 8 years ago.
There has not been that many successes. There hasn't been that many progresses. But we have to think of things in the bigger picture. Our paradigm for divestment is the South African model, the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa, and that took decades before universities eventually began divesting.
Now, pro-Palestine activity on campus is shifting. In January, a group of professors in California called on their universities to sever ties with Israeli academic institutions. Over 160 U.S. academics signed on.
I heard about what happened in San Francisco, and we are talking about 70 professors. We have more universities that in this month send students to Israel and send professors to Israel.
Organizers believe that the outrage inspired by Israel's war on Gaza is galvanizing the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement in the United States.
We saw with the recent attacks against Gaza renewed interest and an anger by a number of activists that previously were not willing to consider boycott, divestment, sanctions. They felt that it was too extreme.
The momentum has pushed the boycott into a new realm, culture. A group in Pittsburgh asked Israel's Batsheva Dance Company to denounce the Israeli government's Gaza offensive, and it picketed its performance when it refused. Adala also helped launch an expanded list of consumer boycott targets. Among them, Motorola, which develops bomb components and communications infrastructure used by the Israeli army.
I don't see the world stop using computers and cell phones. And if you think we're not using computers or cell phones, you're going to hurt us, I don't think it's going to happen.
Seasoned organizers like Bill Fletcher are cautious.
I think that the renewed interest in boycott, divestment, and sanctions is important and was certainly triggered by the Gaza atrocities. But I'm not sure that it's the situation there is enough to keep it going.
You're glitz! You're glam!
Now, he says, boycott organizers have to figure out how to transform that anger and outrage, particularly that of Arab and Muslim Americans, into a lasting political force.
Say I won't take no foreign answer. No way. I'll fight and I'll fight till I reach my goal. Yeah, now. No matter what they do or no matter what they say, not even bad mind can stop me now, yeah. No way, yeah. Say this your work, yeah, it have to be done. This is no time for having fun, yeah. Say we not take no defeat. No way. For Jaja works must complete. Standing yeah. firm on our feet. Stand firm. Yes, we solid like whole concrete. We say we not take no defeat.
Not take no
for Jaja works must complete. Standing firm on our feet. Yes, we solid like whole concrete. Yeah, yeah, now, now. Oh, well. Just like grandma would have said now.
Would have said
yeah.
now.
If you want good, you know the coffee run. Say my way. You should work hard in the burning sun.
So
yes, it's
hard.
A race, yeah, you know we coffee run. No matter what the journey, we have to stand strong. Oh.
take no for an answer. No way, I'll fight and I'll fight till I reach my goal. Listen now, no matter what they say or no matter what they do, not even bad mind can't stop me now. Yeah, yeah. Say this your work, yeah, it had to be done. There is no time for holy but fun anymore. Oh yes, I know we have to be stronger, but through the spirit of Jah, I know we must conquer. Yeah, now. Day by day the journey gets longer, longer. So now my people, let's get together.
Now another idea that people have is that human nature is just basically too selfish and greedy, that we're never going to see any kind of fundamental change in society so long as people remain selfish and greedy. And it's not the point that Marxists think that, you know, oh, no, no, people are really glorious individuals. They never, you know, cut each other off in traffic or, you know, cut online or treat each other like crap. They obviously do. But what we understand is that people's nature is neither particularly good nor particularly bad, but it's particularly blank and is often shaped by the society that you live in. And that's how you can begin to explain why it is that it's very unlikely that as we leave here, to, you know, from this room this afternoon, that we're going to beat the crap out of each other on the way to the bathroom to push each other over from the tap. Because we know that if we want water, there's going to be plenty of water later on. When there's plenty of something, you don't go and you're not in competition for it. There's plenty of it. We don't have to fight over it. But of course, as soon as that resource is made rare, is held from us, then of course people are pitted into competition. And that's precisely what the society that we live in does. A society based on profit for the few and the squelching and denial of human need actually, you know, throws us into competition for schools, for housing, for healthcare, for all sorts of things. Things that want to be due us by virtue of just being on the planet. You know, but you also see counterexamples in which for moments you can see glimpses of how people could actually act otherwise. I mean, the response around the world, really, not just around the United States, to what happened in Hurricane Katrina was actually quite enormous. Most people didn't turn on the TV, see a bunch of poor people, you know, who've lost absolutely everything, and say, damn, good thing it's not me. You know, most people were absolutely horrified, absolutely traumatized by the reality that in the most wealthy country on the planet, you can have hundreds of thousands of people basically lose everything, and the government does absolutely nothing. But it's a source of outrage for people, and we have to question, why is it, you know, that outrage enough doesn't seem to be sufficient for people to overcome the way our society works?
I understand Israel's desire to protect itself.
The donkey is tired and thin.
I think what the Israelis are doing is very important.
The elephant thinks he'll move in.
Israel has no choice but to take military action.
They yell and they fuss, but they ain't fooling us, 'cause their brother's right under the skin.
The Israelis are doing the only thing they can possibly do to defend their population.
It's the same, same.
The missile firings into Israel, I think, brought a proper response from the Israelis.
The donkey and elephant bob up and down on the same merry-go-round.
All Americans know what we would be doing if rockets were landing in San Diego from Tijuana.
From the south.
Missiles were coming out of Cuba into but South Florida that we wouldn't respond.
If I do and rule you, 'cause they've got the same bit in the mind.
If this were going on in the United States from Vancouver, Canada, into Seattle, would we react?
Same, same merry-go-round. Which one will you ride this year?
We will wage the war that has to be won.
Donkey and elephant. Bob up and down on the same merry-go-round.
Israel can-
can defend itself from any threat, from Gaza to Tehran.
His appointments are just pro-Israeli hawks, right down the line. Clinton, Dennis Ross, Dan Kretzer, who's the most moderate among them, and who is his Middle East advisor, was the co-author, or helper at least, in the speech that he gave to AIPAC, which broke records in obsequiousness. No one has ever gone that far. In fact, he went so far that his campaign had to publicly withdraw some of his statements. He stated that to AIPAC that Jerusalem must remain the undivided capital of Israel.
And Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel, and it must remain undivided.
I mean, first of all, it's radically opposed to international law. It's against Security Council resolutions that the U.S. supported. It's against U.S. policy. And it was so extreme that his campaign had to essentially retract it and say, well, the words didn't mean what he said. That's what we know. So you can guess what you want. Guess right now would be that it will probably be like the second Bush administration.
Home now. See their lies. Read their fight. See their lies. So we love it here and we tell them it.
Stay back the power.
Ooh.
We, as revolutionaries, are confronted with a certain caricature of what it means to have a revolution. Now, the caricature of a revolution that's passed off by most historians, of course, is that of a small group of pretty heavily armed fanatics who seize control of the government and basically run it to enrich themselves. That's essentially the story we're all told in different languages and dialects, but that's pretty much the same story the world over. And really, we understand as socialists that this has absolutely nothing to do with socialism as we Marxists understand it. It has nothing to do with genuine socialism. A minority, no matter how well intended that minority may well be, cannot carry out a socialist revolution. At the heart of socialism, to us as Trotskyists, as people who believe not only in revolution, in workers' power, in self-emancipation of the working class, who follow the ideas of or adhere to a tradition known as Trotskyism, one of the leading revolutionaries who led the Red Army during the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, we understand it this way. This is the way Trotsky explained the revolution. I think it's quite clever. He said, the most indubitable feature of a revolution is the direct interference of the masses in historic events. In ordinary times, the state, be it monarchical or democratic, elevates itself above the nation, and history is made by specialists in that line of business, kings, ministers, bureaucrats, parliamentarians, journalists, etc. But at those crucial moments when the old order becomes no longer endurable to the masses, they break over the barriers excluding them from the political arena, sweep aside their traditional representatives, and create by their own interference the initial groundwork for a new regime. The history of a revolution is for us, first and foremost, a history, a history of forcible entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. And in fact, that was the real history of the Russian Revolution, far from, you know, some putschist led by some guy named Lenin, who was so clever that he managed to seduce the entire population of, you know, of some 150 million or so, whatever the population was at that time, of Russia, into overthrowing the Tsar, taking over control of industry and running society entirely differently. No, hardly, far from it. Nobody, as a matter of fact, most of the people in the Bolshevik Party didn't even agree with the fellow. They had all sorts of arguments. They thought it was a complete crackpot. They had two revolutions, in fact. The first one got rid of the Tsar, and they said, okay, now we've done it. Now we've had our revolution. He said, what, are you crazy? Now you've got to take control of property. You got rid of the top guy. Now you got rid of the entire class of owners. And that was an enormous argument. It was in the course of that struggle, in the course of those months between February and October of 1917, that the masses entered into the state, that the working class in enormous numbers formed these things called Soviets. In Iran, during their revolution, they called them shortas, and other places they've been called all sorts of committees. Essentially, workers' councils got formed in which debates happened, fights happened, some face fights too, undoubtedly. People were arguing about real things, about whether, you know, questions that were going to shape whether or not they were going to survive or whether or not they were going to be crushed. There were important battles that took place, and it was millions of people who stepped onto the stage of history for the first time, millions of people debating into the night. In fact, Lenin's wife describes walking down the street and how it used to take hours to go from one, you know, just get home, because there would be all these circles of people who for the first time had actually had a stake in what was going on and were playing a central role in the shaping of their futures. We're standing on every street corner arguing everything from, you know, what would it mean, you know, should we be armed, do we get rid of this guy over here who's sort of a semi-reformist, or do we work with him for a period of time, all sorts of debates. And people came to the resolution for themselves that they needed to not only overthrow the one fellow at the top, but the entire layer of people at the top.
The numbers are staggering. The economic stimulus bill that is worth $787 billion. That's enough money to buy nearly 2,500 Airbus 380s, the world's largest passenger jets. But how does all that cash trickle down to everyday Americans?
But I don't see it helping me, and all these people getting deals and stuff, it's not helping me.
From England to Poland, every step across the ocean, the ruling class is them is in a mess. Oh yes, the capitalist system a regress, but the Soviet system now progress. So which one of them you think is best? When are the two of them the workers a contest? When crisis is the order of the day, when so much people crying out for change nowadays. So what about the working class, Comrade German? What about the working class? They bear the cost, they carry the cross, and them not go forget them tongues in Gadans. Them not go forget them tongues.
From the east to the west, to the land I love the best. The ruling class is them is in a mess. Oh yes, crisis is the order of the day. The workers them demanding more pay every day. The peasants want a lot more say nowadays. The youth them rebelling everywhere. Everywhere, insurrection is the order of the day. There's a lot of people crying out for change nowadays. Nobody blame it on the black working class, Mr. Racist. Blame it on the ruling class. Blame it on your capitalist boss. We pay the cost, we suffer the loss. And we're not going to get new cross, not a rust. We're not going to get new cross. I love the best. The ruling class is them is in a mess. Oh yes, crisis is the order of the day. The workers them demanding more pay every day. The peasants want a lot more say nowadays. The youth them rebelling everywhere. Everywhere, insurrection is the order of the day. There's a lot of people crying out for change nowadays. Nobody blame it on the black working class, Mr. Racist. Blame it on the ruling class. Blame it on your capitalist boss. We pay the cost, we suffer the loss. And we're not going to get new cross, not a rust. We're not going to get new cross.
But we also need to understand that struggle is necessary in order for us to get change, because struggle itself transforms people and gives them actually confidence in their own power. If you have no confidence that you can possibly change anything, you know, you're not about to go fight to change the world. If you won't even fight for a 15-minute bathroom break, you're highly unlikely to change, you know, to argue or fight for the transformation of society as we know. You've got even small struggles can be transformative for people. And we understand that struggle is central to the shifting of ideas in society. And this is the way Marx put it. He said, revolution is necessary not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of ages and become fit to found society anew. In other words, yes, it's true. Lots of us do have ideas, but actually in the course of the struggle itself, we're forced to confront those ideas and they're challenged by the struggle itself. For example, if you look at the average strike, workers are forced to deal with the fact that there were divisions in our ranks, divisions that have been sown throughout our lives, right? Told that, you know, women are this and they shouldn't be on the front lines because, of course, they're very meek and they're very fragile and we have to take care of them. Or, you know, blacks, they're, you know, lazy sons of bitches. They're going to just cross the picket line anyway. So all these kinds of crap ideas that we've, you know, had pushed into our heads, that we've been bombarded with forever and a day, are forced to be confronted. I know, you know, a few years ago, town of Decatur, Illinois, three companies went on strike simultaneously. Caterpillar, Bridgestone, Firestone, and a place that basically processes the stuff that goes in beer, whatever that is, were either locked out or on strike simultaneously. And this is a town, it's largely white, although there is a number of blacks in the town, in which the Ku Klux Klan actually had organized a branch, which, you know, doesn't actually happen in most cities, by the way. It's not like the Ku Klux Klan is a growing operation. You know, we don't have little fascist gangs. But this is one of those towns in the United States, a small town in America, you know, sort of downwardly mobile industrial town. When that strike happened, actually because, you know, they were confronted with the question of how do we form solidarity in our ranks? these three unions got together, the workers in these three different unions got together and actually argued among themselves that for the first time, actually since the early 1960s, they were going to initiate and lead a Martin Luther King Day march. And in fact, they elected black women to the leadership of their sort of united kind of strike newspaper, which hadn't happened in decades in the United States, and by the way, hasn't happened since. And it was the course of the actual struggle itself that compelled people to confront some of these ideas. There were arguments. It's not as though, you know, once you go into strike, you all of a sudden put on your progressive head and you've got the best ideas in the world. People argued it out. There actually weren't any revolutionaries down there initially. We certainly got wind of it and went down there. And you'd better believe it. And then they began to tour around the entire United States, and they called themselves road warriors, and they had a whole campaign. And the ideas and the struggle and the fight actually spread from one town to the other, so that people built solidarity in cities across the United States with this little town that they had never heard of, in which a third of the population was out on strike or locked down.
Few of us run our own lives. This is because we have no control over the main decisions that affect us. These decisions are made by small, self-perpetuating minorities. This situation cannot be democratically challenged. What our rulers call democracy is a system which operates for their own protection. As long as their democracy is not seriously challenged, their dominating position in society is secure. The threatened use of violence is intended to frustrate any challenge. It is implicit in the large police force, the courts, and the armed forces which they control. The limited freedom that their democracy allows us is further restricted or curtailed altogether whenever they think their power is seriously threatened. They hold the power to maintain their power. This is the key to their security. They determine the kind of education provided and the ways and means of providing it. By controlling what and how people are taught, those who rule us seek to preserve the structure of existing society. Children are educated first through the family, i.e., through the already conditioned parents. Then the education factories, the schools, and universities take over. Their aim is to produce people conditioned to fit into this rat race society. Workers created trade unions and political parties to change all this. But gradually adopting similar patterns of organization to those of their oppressors, and by concentrating the struggle almost solely on improving working conditions and living standards, the original revolutionary intentions have been bypassed. Working people have gained considerable material advantages, but they have lost control of their own organizations. Today, the hierarchies are in control. They can neither be removed nor brought back to the initial aim of freeing people. Those who dominate production dominate society. So long as they have their kind of industrial stability, control will remain in their hands. This control enables them to continue deciding what is to be produced, who is to produce it, where, when, how, and in what quantities. All this conflicts with the interests of the real producers, the workers. Those who run our lives continually seek ways of blurring the conflict and of manipulating workers into accepting that management alone is capable of making these decisions. But the system is contested. There is a constant struggle in which the objective is self-management. In a large majority of disputes, workers have taken real democratic decisions to act without the consent of the union bureaucrats, so-called unofficial strikes. This is one of the signs that our rulers' industrial stability is under strain. The strain is also visible in the education factories, where students are increasingly demanding the right to take decisions on fundamental issues. There are many other signs of the crisis that is affecting every aspect of this society. We are participating in this struggle wherever possible. We try to expose the true situation. We seek to strengthen the confidence of working people in their own ability to manage their own lives, at work and outside of it. People's reliance on others to do things for them has led to defeat after defeat. It is time for victories. Victories depend on people consciously taking action themselves. To help in the development of this consciousness is the only reason for the existence of Seeing Red Radio. That's a solidarity leaflet from July of 1969, adapted for use for Seeing Red Radio. Please stay tuned. Wraps up this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. For all the links to all the stories and music that you heard this evening, by all means, go down to the website at seeingredradio.org. Check out the articles, check out the links. If you missed the show, podcast it. We are in the iTunes universe. Thanks all for tuning in. Remember, we got a world to win. We have nothing to lose but our chains. Workers of the world, unite. Peace, comrades.